the Indiana Black Caucus unveils its justice reform agenda. Indiana schools get guidance on reopening. Plus, Hoosier prisons not following CDC guidelines and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending June 12, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus wants Governor Eric Holcomb to ban the use of chokeholds by police during arrests, one of a series of actions the caucus recommends to address justice reform. The recommendations come amid protests across the state about racial justice and police brutality, and Black Caucus Chair Robin Shackelford says she thinks those protests are why their agenda might now get more traction.
Everyone has been sick and tired for many years, but now they're really sick and tired.
The first step the caucus wants, an executive order from the governor banning chokehold restraints by law enforcement. Failing that, Shackelford says local officials should establish such policies.
This order must include specific repercussions officers will face by violating this ban.
The caucus also wants local leaders to establish independent civilian review boards to oversee public complaints of police violence. Will the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus's agenda get anywhere at the State House? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, banning chokeholds was just one item and a short-term sort of solution in terms of something that could happen right away. Others, though, would come during the legislative session, things like statewide mandated use of body and dashboard cameras, enhanced penalties for officer-involved shootings, ensuring that FOP police union contracts are public record and requiring a public hearing for their renewal. Do any of these sorts of things really have a chance?
Well, I think they do, especially given the current conversation, and I think they should. The legislative session is a long way off, right? I mean, the world changes in a day, right? We weren't talking about this at all 2 weeks ago. We have a session that's 7 months from now. So I think they do. I think the Black Caucus and all legislators or advocates have to be careful about how much they want the a governor, any governor, reacting to the things that are happening in real life on as a matter of executive order instead of deliberating these through the legislature. So I think some of these have a very good chance. I think we've seen body cams come online in Republican and Democratic controlled cities or run cities. So I don't think there is certainly a Democratic bend to these reforms, but I think we've seen in other places, parts of the country, Republicans go along with them, and I think it deserves a real and serious debate.
Ann Delaney, the Black Caucus's annual legislative agenda is usually mostly ignored at the State House, but is this coming session going to be different given the time and everything that is going on right now?
I really hope so. I mean, I think that there's been an awakening in the country to problems that have been endemic in the criminal justice system for 100, 200, 300 years, and it's time to address them. And I think there's momentum to address them. I mean, even in the Republican-controlled U.S. Senate, they're talking about banning chokeholds and some of the more obvious things, like the body cameras on the car and the police officer, not only shine public light on their conduct, they also protect the police officers. Those vast majority of police officers who are doing the job correctly have protection because there's a visual record of what happened in the stop. So a lot of those make sense. They cost money, but they make sense. And, you know, the governor maybe can't do it all by himself, but he certainly could ask the state police to ban them. He could certainly start publicizing how many black police officers we have in the state police, how many we have in the positions of authority, what he's going to do about that. Those are all things, it seems to me, that he can do that can make a real difference and show that he's trying to deal with what everybody recognizes is a huge problem.
Nikki Kelly, Ann Delaney just alluded to this, but a couple of the items on their justice reform agenda, including notably the police and or the body camera and dashboard camera things, would cost money. If we are going to tell local communities that they have to have these and use them, we should be expecting the state to provide the money for that. Now, in a normal year, maybe that could get more of attention, but we're going to be heading into a budget session in 2021 in which nobody's going to have any money, right?
True. And also, to be fair, you have a lot of cities and towns and counties who have already put out the money and added body cams. And so there's some sort of maybe a grant program where it's a matching grant, maybe they could work something like that through. But obviously money is going to be scarce for any new priorities as we're even trying to basically keep our current spending there.
Now, John, some of these things Mike and Ann have both pointed out, that these are things that Republicans and Democrats have started to come around behind. Things like banning chokeholds seems to be one that a lot of folks are willing to get behind. But something like FOP contracts, making them more public, enhancing penalties when there's an officer involved or police shooting. Do you think that a majority of Republicans, because that's really what's going to matter at the State House, it seems, do you think a majority of Republicans are willing to get behind some of those things?
Well, those certainly would face more of an uphill battle than perhaps what we could describe as the obvious and immediate steps, such as the prohibition of the chokehold. But I think a lot of it depends on what we see from here on out. There was the suggestion, I think, in Mike's response that 7 months is a long time before the session starts, and certainly that's true. But let's keep in mind that this story, while it is certainly the proverbial slice of time when the death certainly of in the Minneapolis case occurred, and maybe some of the protests are perhaps subsiding. Let's keep in mind that the criminal justice process, sometimes the wheels turn slowly. We may not see the trial, if there are trials for these police officers or others in Buffalo and some of the other incidents where officers have been charged, until much closer to the session. And depending on the outcomes of those proceedings, we could see a reignition perhaps of the public unrest. I would also just point out that in terms of the chokehold, just before we started this taping, no one less than the president himself suggested that a certain level of discomfort with chokeholds, and even though he described them outwardly as seeming perfect and innocent, were his words, he did leave open or sort of suggest that the White House guidelines that are forthcoming would not look favorably on chokeholds. And, of course, that would put him in line with the Democratic proposal that came out of the U.S. House. And any number of states, New York had the Eric Garner law enacted just this week, which prohibits chokeholds at the state level. And we've seen municipalities, including Minneapolis and Denver and San Diego, Houston and others, that have done so on a local level. So I think that one is in all likelihood going to satisfy, shall we say, the agenda of the Black legislative.
One of the big problems with this is the ability of the police departments to weed out the bad apples. And that's one of the things that has to be addressed. And that may have to do with the contract, or it may have to do with a reform in the way we keep the statistics and what we do. But that's a huge problem. That officer had 17 complaints against him, and the head of the FOP in Minneapolis had 29. And I look at that and I say, what are they still doing wearing uniforms?
Well, schools now have guidance to help them plan as they reopen buildings to students and staff. The state unveiled a comprehensive set of guidelines for them to consider as they will shape what school will look like after months of building closures. The guidance says schools should maintain social distancing and offers options to consider, including changing the length and timing of school breaks, classroom layouts, and busing procedures. It also recommends schools screen students and staff and follow CDC guidance that people in schools should wear masks. Governor Eric Holcomb was asked about how he would ensure schools could afford to follow the recommendations. He didn't answer, but did say schools can choose how they follow the guidelines.
They are recommendations. They are guardrails that we put into place. And if it's someone who a school that chooses a hybrid approach, an e-learning and an in-school, both options, so be it.
During a webinar with school leaders Tuesday, schools chief Jennifer McCormick said local health departments will largely determine what plans should look like.
If your plan with your local health department says no mask, then that is up to you and your local health department.
McCormick says the governor's office plans to buy 2 million masks to distribute to schools. She says her department is reviewing how that will be done.
Andalini Rush County and Ripley County are going to look different than Marion and Allen and Lake. So how should local schools be given this much flexibility?
Local schools should be given some leadership, and that's what's missing from this. I mean, we should say that at the very least, you need to do A, B, C, D, and E in order to open, okay? Not a 38-page dissertation on all the possible ways you could slice it. I mean, even something as simple as when schools should open. I mean, none of that guidance has been provided. 2 million masks sounds like a lot, but we have more than 1 million students. And these masks are not designed to be used for a year. What about the employees of these places? I mean, we really should have some basic things that each school district has to do if they're going to have in-person schooling in order to open. And they should be told they open on a certain date, and they should be told if they're not doing these things, either they have to apply for some kind of a waiver of it, or they can't open. That's what guidance is. That's what leadership is, and that's what's missing.
Mike O'Brien, is there too much flexibility here?
I don't think so. I think schools want that flexibility. I think when you put it's something as simple as how you arrange the chairs in a classroom, that can affect particularly poor school districts more than affluent school districts that can maybe accommodate that or go buy new furniture and rearrange a classroom that way. And it was part of some of the recommendations in the report. I think someone's going to get left behind in that if you become too restrictive, and they're not going to be able to do it. And they've wanted that flexibility over the course of history to implement and comply with state requirements or state recommendations. And when the states come down on them and told, no, you got to do it this way, they've not liked that. And it's been a point of contention between the state and locals. So I think the locals need flexibility, but they also need state support.
John Schwanis, Mike just alluded to this. Is part of the problem with the state mandating anything as it relates to COVID-19 safety guidelines that it would almost certainly come with a price tag?
Well, it would, and that would be problematic for the very reason you pointed out just a few moments ago, which is the one thing we don't have an ample supply now and certainly won't have an ample supply in 7 months when the General Assembly reconvenes is money, state dollars, just the opposite. But I think what the governor has done thus far and what we saw this week is really not out of line with what his counterparts across the country, at least those that have weighed in with guidelines, proposed guidelines thus far, he's not really out of line with those on both sides of the aisle. Ron DeSantis, certainly, who seems to be the standard bearer in Florida, Republican of the, should we say, the laxest standards, he's sort of put forth some ideas that but again, gave schools a lot of latitude in how to comply or enforce them this fall. And you might say, well, that's a Republican governor who doesn't heed the warnings. But then you have Ralph Northam, who not only is a Democratic governor in Virginia, but is also a physician. And he took pretty much the same approach this week. He came out with some guidelines about fall school reopening. But the Department of Education of Virginia, even though they are asking for, and the governor is asking for a submission by districts of their back-to-school plans, they went to great lengths at the Department of Education there to say this is not an approval process. The schools, you know, it's their decision. Yeah, we're just kind of looking for areas where we might be able to help, but it's not an approval process. So governors seem loath to be too strict on this matter and seem much more inclined to empower locals to make the decisions that they deem best for their students and their teachers.
So they don't have to decide.
Nikki, I don't know about you, but I had gotten messages for weeks from parents and teachers and school leaders saying, when are we going to find out? When are we going to get guidance? When are we going to have more certainty from the state on what we should do to reopen? Well, we have these guidelines now. Do you think those folks are feeling that certainty?
No. I mean, we have a lot of guidelines and a lot of possibilities, but no certainty. And they all have to, I mean, let's face it, they all have to take the backlash of whatever they decide, the mask issue being the biggest one. Parents are saying repeatedly that if they don't, you know, they don't want to have their kid wear a mask every day. And so that will impact who goes back. And at the same time, I'm a little confused. It seems sometimes we want to mandate it and sometimes we don't. We're requiring every restaurant worker to wear a mask, but not a teacher. I mean, I just don't really understand some of the, you know, the differences between the rules.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should Indiana's school reopening guidance include mandates for every district? No, schools need maximum flexibility. Or B, yes, there are some basic requirements all schools should follow. Last week, we asked you who will win Indiana's 5th congressional district race this fall, now that we know who the two candidates. 74% of you say Christina Hale, the Democrat, will win, compared to 26% who say the Republican Victoria Spartz will win. I'm going to go out on a limb and say the final tally after Election Day will not look like that. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, an Indiana Department of Correction policy may increase the spread of coronavirus in prisons by requiring high-risk and medium-risk staffers to report to work. Side Effects Public Media reported this week that, according to internal documents, the DOC broke with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's guidance for prisons. The CDC says prison staff should self-quarantine for 14 days after close contact with an infected person. By mid-April, the state required prison employees without symptoms to come to work, even if they live with someone who tests positive for COVID-19. Health experts say the policy could allow staff to introduce the virus into prisons, which are already especially vulnerable to disease outbreaks. The Department of Corrections says it changed its policy to align with CDC guidance for critical workers, which allows staff to return to work even after contact with a COVID-positive person. DOC also says correctional facilities, quote, apply the guidelines as dictated by local needs and applicability. Nikki Kelly, we heard from the Department of Correction today, Friday, on the governor's press conference on COVID-19, and they were saying that the numbers are looking better. They haven't had a death in a little while. But is this really the best policy for these high-risk facilities?
I don't know. One thing I can't argue with is that they're not critical workers. They clearly are, and I know that they have a short, you know, they have a short staffing issue, so they're really struggling to make sure they have enough staff to guard everyone who's there. This is one of those cases, you know, your mom used to tell you when you were young, if you're cutting off your nose to spite your face, you know, you might be filling a couple shifts at the front end, but if you get a bunch of other staffers sick by coming to work with it, then that hurts you in the long run.
I was going to ask kind of that very question to you, John Schwanis. This seems to be a push and pull of, yes, I don't think anybody would argue that the folks who are staffing our prisons are critical workers. But given what we know about the high-risk scenarios that these facilities and any long-term care facility has in the midst of this crisis, is it really a good idea if you know, for instance, if your spouse at home tested positive for COVID-19, let's say I'm another employee, do I really want to be standing next to someone whose spouse is COVID positive?
I'm sure we can all stipulate that it's not a good idea. Right. Why enhance exposure? Why enhance risk? Well, the reason why is, what alternative is there? The only real alternative, it would seem to me, is to do what some groups, including the American Civil Liberties Union, has suggested, which is reducing significantly, even if temporarily, the prison populations with minimal security risk offenders, nonviolent offenders. And of course, that organization has even petitioned departments of correction and administrations in several states, as well as courts, state Supreme Courts in various jurisdictions to move in that direction. They haven't. The state it does not want to do that. It's not comfortable doing that. Perhaps not surprisingly, the state hasn't looked kindly on a lot of early release and furlough programs, even when they're tied to something as unusual as perhaps a global pandemic. So within those parameters, there's only so much you can do. Yeah. That pretty much is, I guess, shuffle the workforce as best you can.
Yeah. So to that point, Mike O'Brien, with the state's unwillingness to let folks out in any capacity, really, for the most part, is this really the only situation it can find itself in, where high-risk staffers, as long as they're asymptomatic, simply have to come in?
I agree with everything Nikki said on staffing issues and the essential workers. I mean, another thing you have to remember is that we reformed Indiana's criminal justice system over the last decade. These are not people awaiting trial. These are not people that have been charged but not convicted. These are people that, at a minimum, have completed a level 5 felony. in the Department of Corrections system. So this idea that we just temporarily reduce the population and somehow bring it back, I don't understand. One, that there is no upside to that from a public safety standpoint or public health standpoint.
And Delaney, is this simply where the state finds itself, between a rock and a hard place?
It's not where the state finds itself. It's where the governor wants to be. He wants to be politically correct and he wants to be tough on crime. Okay, I understand that. But you have elderly in those prisons that are not in any way, shape, or form a risk of violent crime. You have people ending or close to being ending their terms in there. And if you're in there for a level 5 felony, the last I looked at the code, it wasn't a death sentence. And that's what we're risking here. And I think that shows a remarkable lack of concern about what they might be foisting on people who are not in a position to protect themselves.
All right. Well, Indiana entered the next stage of its reopening plan this week, and today, in fact, Friday, June 12th, a couple of days ahead of where it originally planned, though some counties, for instance, Marion County, will be about a week behind. Now, stage 4 of the Back on Track plan allows groups of up to 250 people to gather. Retail stores and malls no longer have capacity limits, though the state is still urging proper social distancing.
Governor Eric Holcomb says some locations will now get their first opportunity to reopen to the public since the pandemic began.
Cultural and entertainment tourism sites, such as museums and zoos and aquariums, are all up to 50% of capacity, open for 50%. Movie theaters, bowling alleys, open at 50%.
Bars and nightclubs can now also open at 50% capacity. So too can amusement and water parks and playgrounds. State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box says parents still need to take precautions with their kids at those public locations.
Carry that hand sanitizer along with you. Encourage your children to wear masks if they can, especially if they're on the merry-go-round with another 5 or 6 kids. Encourage them to social distance, but I know they're probably not going to do that very well.
Box says parents should try to avoid feeding their children at a playground.
John Schwannis, Indiana averaged more than 400 new confirmed COVID cases every day during stage 3, which we just left. Is this moving forward too fast?
Well, again, it seems to me that the answer to that question lies in one's vantage point. If I'm a public health professional, I would say I'm scared to death that this is going to cause a spike in cases. And as a practical matter, we've seen that in any number of states after the Memorial Day weekend, when there was a dramatic lessening of restrictions, and we've seen now spikes in those states as well. If I were, on the other hand, somebody worried about economic development, somebody worried, a business owner, I would say, yeah, this is worth it. We need to. We can't stifle the economy forever. We need to, because of the job losses we've had, the economic devastation that has been wrought by this, we need to start moving in the right direction. I would just note that the metric seems to have changed a bit, if I'm not mistaken. Early on, this governor and others talked about 14 days, and this was borrowing from the CDC proposals issued, several months back, 14 days of consecutive decreases in diagnoses. And I noticed the administration actually talked about 14 consecutive days of new hospitalizations or hospitalizations. And I don't know if those necessarily are synonymous, diagnoses and hospitalizations.
All right. Well, Nikki Kelly, you asked this very question at today's press conference. Does it feel like we're getting mixed messages from the state here?
I mean, I know Hoosiers who are reaching out to me feel mixed. I mean, on one hand, you have Dr. Box saying you should still limit your excursions and stay 6 feet and social distance. On the other hand, we're saying go to the movies and you know, you can go to the water park and the bars and the nightclubs and 250 people can gather. I do want to correct one thing that John said. The Holcomb administration never once said that one of our principles was 14 days of decline cases. They have made clear from the beginning the cases would continue to go up. Their main issues are hospital beds, surge capacity, testing, and contact tracing.
And those, and we haven't seen declines
with hospitalizations.
Yeah, we haven't seen necessarily declines in the ICU bed and ventilator capacity. What we've seen is for months now, they've pretty much been steady. They kind of just go like this, but all in this kind of pocket where they've been for a while.
Hospital admissions have been trending down, though.
Yes, hospital admissions have been trending down. Mike O'Brien, one of the keys that a lot of public health experts talk about in terms of anybody's ability to reopen has been widespread availability of testing. And we are increasing our testing. A new lab network that will launch soon will double our testing capacity by about early to mid-July. Just today they announced that at the 50 or so Optum sites around the state that any Hoosier can now get tested. You don't have to be symptomatic. You don't have to be high risk or anything like that. If you want to test, you can get it. Is that a key to how all of this works?
Well, yeah, and you can't tie. You can't. The relationship between new cases and moving these stages was always about maintaining capacity in the hospital system. That was it. That was the goal from the beginning of the shutdown, to make sure that people that needed hospitalization could get it and that we all didn't get sick at once.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, and that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.